This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wisconsin's Joint Finance Committee approved a K-12 education package this week that expands funding for public schools and private school vouchers. Lawmakers found money to restore cuts that Governor Scott Walker had proposed for public schools. Before all of this took place, Republicans were in La Crosse last week for the Wisconsin Republican Convention. A few state legislators stopped by our studios in between sessions to talk more about the budget and their own priorities this year. We were joined by Representative John Nygren of Marinette, who serves as co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, Representative Lee Nierison of Westby, chair of the Committee on Agriculture, and Representative Nancy Vandermeer of TOMA, vice chair of the Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. Talking about the budget, I'm wondering if there's a way any of you are able to sort of summarize briefly your take on the budget and sort of how the budget process has been coming along. Representative Nygren, you're deep in this.
We are. I'm not sure there is a way to summarize it briefly because it's such a important process we go through. The governor introduces the budget in February. We have briefings from the agencies, but then most importantly, we go out and we listen to the public. We had four public hearings throughout the state, but in addition to that, just the Republicans in the assembly, we had well over 100 listening sessions on the budget in local districts throughout the state. And then we come back and, you know, we begin to make changes and or approve things as we go on. That's kind of the point we're at right now. And the input from local legislators on how things affect their local communities is probably the number one thing that we listen to because it's hard for us to be able to have an ear in Viroqua or in TOMA. That's really something that I think is significant. And these two legislators' credit, they've been very involved in the process.
And Representative Nieren, go ahead.
Yeah, this is my sixth budget, and each one is a little bit different, but I think this time, all the way through, you've always got a good chance to get your input in it. That's one thing I have to give Joint Finance credit for.
And Representative Vandermeer, this being your first budget process, what has that been like?
I think it's very eye-opening, first of all. As a newcomer, one of the things that is amazing to me is the complexity. I have on my desk, and I usually point it out to the visitors who come to my office, is that budget is nearly 1,700 pages when it starts out. And I have it front and center on my desk so people can appreciate that. And I think it is an amazing process. As John had said a moment ago, that we take into consideration and try to engage with our constituents in those local forums, like our listening sessions. In fact, I participated in over 10 of them in my district. And it was it's very important. And we represent everyone. It's important to listen to all the different views. And I am really very heartened by the fact that some significant changes were proposed to the budget. And I look forward to those changes that have been able to be accomplished.
So what are some of the things that you're hearing from your constituents and that you're filtering into the Joint Finance Committee?
I kind of go with my top three. And it was an interesting almost evolution in my listening sessions. It started out in the beginning, and maybe Lee and John can kind of contribute to this as well. But my constituents in the beginning would focus on transportation costs. Mm. And then as there was like an awareness or certain communities of interest would step forward. Of course, K-12 funding, UW funding, those were the three that started in the forefront. As we moved through the process, then we began to hear more from the IRIS community, family care, the senior care for the prescription program. So there was a bit of an evolution as we moved across that spectrum in the listening sessions.
And Representative Nierison, what are you hearing?
Being chair of the Ag Committee, for mine, it was a lot of things in the ag industry. The main ones were the DNR board and the DADCAP board to keep them as they were. And then one of the local issues that I have in my district is the Kickapoo Valley Reserve.
Sure.
And the budget was proposed to go to the DNR. And if you know the history of the reserve, they just wanted nothing to do with the DNR.
And, yeah, just to remind people, there had been a part in the budget that had suggested moving it from the Department of Tourism to the Department of Natural Resources. Hundreds of people turned out saying, we want the Kickapoo Valley to remain as it is.
Yes, it is. And we were lucky enough, so we made that happen. Thanks to the Joint Finance, they listened to us. And Jen worked her side of the aisle, and I worked my side. And and we got a unanimous vote to keep it where it is.
And can you talk about why that was so important?
Well, you have to go back to the history back in the early 70s when the federal government came in and they were going to build this great big dam in Lafarge. So they started buying land. If they couldn't buy it, they would take it by eminent domain. So there's, just about 8,000 acres that was federally owned, and then all of a sudden they quit. The project just disappeared. So then for a long time, the federal government had it, and DNR was kind of coming in and saying, you can't go on that land, you can't do this. So, and then finally, when Tommy Thompson was governor and my predecessor, Dwayne Johnsrud, and former Senator Brian Rood, got the land back from the feds to the state, and then they started in, and that's how the Kickapoo Reserve started. And at that time, they didn't trust Department of Natural Resources around Lafarge area, so they wanted to make sure you had nothing to do with it. And then Ho-Chunk has got 1,200 acres, too, there. So, and they didn't want DNR to have anything to do with it. So that's how the Kickapoo Reserve started. And you're three, four generations removed from the original farmers that were taken off the land. They still remember it. It's still a big issue out there. And they just wanted to make sure it stayed in tourism because it's been working well.
And Representative Nygren, when you have a situation like this, which can seem so local and specialized, but really does impact a lot of people in this area, you know, coming from Marinette, northeastern part of the state.
Well, that's why the process we have is important, because it's impossible for somebody from Marinette to know about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve to the extent that Lee does. So that's why we have the process we do, where our members are, you know, we have meetings on a regular basis to be able to discuss concerns that they have and things that they'd like to see changed. And then we go about, trying to build support within the six members of the Assembly Republican Joint Finance Team to be able to get those changes supported, and then also work with our Senate colleagues to do the same. And as Lee said, you know, a lot of issues are not Republican or Democrat. In this case, that was one of them, where Senator Jen Schilling was also supportive of leaving things as they were. So, and I talked to Jen the night before we took the vote, and you know, got her input as well. I don't think most people probably realize that we have those type of communications with both sides of the aisle quite frequently.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking with a few Republican state lawmakers about the proposed budget and their priorities this year. We spoke last week before the Republican Party of Wisconsin's annual convention in La Crosse. So let's maybe talk about education and funding for education within this budget. At the time that this airs, the Joint Finance Committee has probably decided on funding. But from what I understand, Republicans are working to restore the $127 million in cuts, even though there hasn't been this additional revenue growth. Representative Nygren, you want to expand on that?
Yeah, we've got the resources to be able to fund the first-year reduction that the governor has in his budget. So that's not even in debate. That's something that was unanimous in our caucus, that our members wanted to make sure that we restored that. And I'm confident that will take place, and I am also confident that we will see a increase in the second year. K-12 education, educating our kids, is a priority whether you're from Northeast Wisconsin or southern or Western Wisconsin. So that's something that's been consistent as long as I've been in the legislature, and I'm sure will be for a long time to come.
So as you say, the resources are there. Does that mean certain cuts that have been proposed will remain in place, or you find additional cuts elsewhere?
Well, to this point, We're about halfway through the process of joint finance, and we've already found additional cuts, savings of nearly $50 million. In addition to that, the governor had made basically a double payment on the school levy credit, not only in this biennium, but even going into the next biennium of $106 million. So resources right there allow us to more than fill the first year reduction, and we're confident we have other abilities to be able to put additional revenues into the second year as well.
And Representative Vandermeer, you said that K-12 education was one of the biggest issues you heard about months ago. I mean, assuming as we hear that those cuts will be restored, that's good news. Or you have concerns about how this could impact the budget elsewhere? Or?
No, I'm very heartened by it, I think especially in our rural schools. And that was one of the things I promised when I was campaigning earlier. And I had been involved in my school district in the past. I had been in a school-to-work program and had been, of course, involved in some of the the areas of education. And I always talk about our job market, how we are going to engage future employers, et cetera. And I think this is a great investment for us because we're going to look at better educating or continuing that quality education in our rural schools especially, and then bringing that into the workplace in years to come.
And Representative Neerson, what does this mean for the future of school funding?
Well, I come from clear back when my great-grandfather donated the land to build the first Neerson school on. This is going back quite a few years. And so education is always something that we have forward. And I always, the schools in my area, they're pretty small, a lot of them, but I'll put them up against any other school for competition-wise because they are that good. And I think that's why we can do it in the budget to keep that competitive edge going.
What about funding for voucher schools? This seems to be something that lawmakers don't necessarily agree with, well, of course, across the state, but there seems to be a difference of opinion, too, here in southwest Wisconsin with, you know, the more urban areas versus the extreme rural areas, too. Representative Neerson?
And I know John knows I've said it, I'd like to see it taken out of the budget. And we could talk about open and without being in the budget and then have a vote on it that way. I said that last fall when I was campaigning, and I still would like to see it. And I know John knows I've said that, and a lot of them on Joint Finance know I've said that. So, but you know, that's a decision we have to make as a whole. But so there is a difference on it, and yet I also understand that if it's not working, how come you have if the public school isn't working for them? You know, some schools have maybe 100 kids that are homeschooled. Now, why are they there instead of in the school? So.
And Representative Vandermeer, is this something that you're hearing about from your constituents?
I think in our part of the state, much like Lee's, our schools are usually pretty good. And so we don't have the pressure for that voucher initiative. And, you know, it's really been great in my first couple months of my current time of serving. I visited a number of our schools throughout our 70th district. And when John was just mentioning the innovation that can take place, I've seen that innovation in, I can mention one particular middle school, for example. They've got a traditional middle school, they have a STEM school, and a whole chunk cultural immersion program, too. So, you know, we see those things already, and, you know, hearing John talk about the budget, of course, being involved in that process, once again, it's very heartening for me to know that I think we can really have a very good quality product, as John said.
One other thing that we have in the rural, and everybody does, is open enrollment. But mm-hmm. we do have our schools out here seem to be a little closer. You know, they're not that terrible far apart, a lot of them. So if it's not the education they want here, they'll open enroll to another one.
So do you think that vouchers will be fully funded as it has been proposed, or is there some compromise there?
I think there's going to be more of a compromise. I mean, as the governor proposed it, actually, I don't think it... he's proposed using the state funding formula and basically, you know, putting every child who wants to go into the voucher program basically into like a pool, and the state funding dollars for each school district, you know, that follows the child will go into that pot and then get divided up. Because what most people don't know is there's districts that are very low aided by the state. Even states that have zero aid from the state because of their property values. So, you know, it would not be possible to be able to send a kid from one district with the state resources because there's no state aid. So what he put everybody into a pot and then starts dividing it up. Well, I'm not sure that is workable. I think you'll probably see a smaller, more scaled back proposal when we're all said and done.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking with a few Republican state lawmakers about the proposed budget and their priorities. My guests are Representative John Nygren of Marinette, Representative Nancy Vandermeer of Toma, and Representative Lee Neerson of Westby. So let's talk about cuts to the University of Wisconsin system. There's people concerned about the $300 million you know, the Joint Finance Committee, is there any sense as to how you all will be approaching this, Representative Nygren?
Well, I mean, it's been the Speaker, Robin Voss, myself, and others have, Dean Knudsen, who's on the Joint Finance Committee. He represents the Hudson area. He's got River Falls and, you know, Menominee or Stout in his backyard as well. A number of us have made an effort to try and look for ways to reduce that cut. And I think we can do we can get there. How big a reduction remains to be seen. But I think you're going to also see, we've had regular meetings with Ray Cross and the board and some of the Board of Regents about, you know, some creative things that we could do to give them some flexibilities. You've heard discussions about out-of-state tuition.
Sure.
There's some that have been critical of that. Actually, if you compare us to our neighbors, we're talking about
raising out-of-state tuition.
Out-of-state tuition. Compared to our neighbors, I think we're getting a pretty good deal here in Wisconsin, including the people that are coming from out of state. And if our focus is, this is the state of Wisconsin, this is about, for me, the number one priority has to be controlling the cost for the kids from Wisconsin. So, you know, I think that that proposal is bringing in about $61 million in of itself. That coupled with some reductions from our side. So I think we can, from joint finance, more GPR, I think we can actually get to a point where we're going to be able to, our number one goal is to not see this affect students. And I think we can get there.
And Representative Nierson, is this something you're hearing much about? And
You know, the main things we're hearing are education, K-12 and university system. So, I'm hoping we can find more. Right now we're still working, you know, we're all working together trying to see what we can come up with. But we haven't had a lot of discussion yet because we kind of do item by item.
Sure.
We work
K-12
on this
right
one.
Now.
Yeah. You work on that one, and then when that gets voted on, then you move on to the next one. And you kind of work a little bit on everything, but you focus more as they're going to be coming up.
I think it's important also to kind of keep this in context a little bit. With the original proposal with the $300 million cut was a public authority for the UW system.
Which seems to be a dead deal.
It's done. It's dead. We've said it's dead. And this is actually something the system has been asking for quite a long time. So, I mean, to the governor, you know, and the governor's taken a lot of heat for the cut, and understandably so, but this was part of a bigger plan and something the system has been asking for years, but it's something we identified fairly early on.
Do you think it could be addressed outside of the budget?
I think it could be at a later point.
Sure.
We addressed early on, even the Board of Regents, some of the stakeholders within the system were not necessarily buying into this. So when the system was actually developed back in the 70s, it took 2 years to be able to, you know, of discussions, of planning, of preparation, to be able to build the UW system that we have today. We kind of take it for granted, you know, that, you know, how long that actually took is pretty amazing. So possibly with maybe a similar type planning and process, we can get to that point, but we're not there now.
People are calling on the state to accept these federal Medicaid funds. Some say this could fill the budget gap that we have. Is this something that the joint finance can take up? Is this something that the legislature could take up? How exactly can this work
First of all, we won't. I'll just make it clear, we will not.
Republicans or Joint Finance Committee?
Republicans or the Joint Finance Committee will not be accepting the Medicaid dollars. And I think you need to keep this in perspective, too. First of all, more people in Wisconsin now have insurance than ever before. For the first time ever, everybody at 100% of poverty level has Badger Care in Wisconsin. So, I mean, that's something we should be proud of. In addition to that, everybody that's over the federal poverty level has the ability to go to the exchange and get subsidies from the federal government. Now, we did say no to the dollars from the federal government, but something that you need to keep in back of your mind on this discussion is while the dollars are not coming to the state, the dollars are actually coming to the individual person who's on the exchange. They're getting that subsidy. It's going to them rather than to the state. So if it came to the state, it would be Medicaid. When it's going to them, that's private insurance. And they have a much higher reimbursement rate. And one of the things that these folks, I'm sure, are already hearing from our hospitals and our clinics, that the reimbursement for Medicaid in Wisconsin, unfortunately, is one of the lowest in the nation. And that actually, you know, continues to drive the cost for people that are on private pay. So the more people we can get on private pay, the better off we're going to be. In addition to that, one of the reasons Medicaid has been such a cost driver of our state is because the reliance on the federal dollars. It has gone, since my time in the legislature, it's gone from about 70 cents on the dollar, because it's a state and federal partnership, to about 58 cents on the dollar coming from the federal government. So reliance on federal dollars can be dangerous as well, and that's why one of the main reasons why we did not accept it.
But as we see Medicaid costs keep rising within the state, I think it's up $700 million this year. So, I mean, even accepting those federal Medicaid funds, that wouldn't do anything to really help
with
that?
It'd be a one-year solution. you know, we'd be in the same situation, you know, down the road. Is, you know, I guess our position. And as I said, as populations shift, as demographics change, that's when we see the reduction from that 70 cents on the dollar to that 58 cents on the dollar. The federal government made a promise to, I believe it was 90% over the first few years and gradually declining. One of the differences between us and the federal government is we have to have a balanced budget. They do not. And relying on them when they have, in our view, pretty difficult finances, it is not something that we're comfortable doing.
And Representative Neerson, is that something you agree with, not taking that money right now?
Right now, I don't think it is anything we should be doing. I like John said, it's things we have to do in our state and watch our dollars and spend them the way we have them. So, I don't think it would be the right time to do it. It looks good, and it's a good soundbite that, oh, we're going to solve all our losses, our hole, or whatever you want to call it. And it might for a little while, but it's still going to keep going up, and we're still going to have them there.
And Representative Vandermeer, you're nodding your head in agreement.
Yes. No, I agree completely. I served on a hospital board for about 6 years, and Medicaid reimbursements are, as John alluded to, are typically low, and you have a certain expense structure in that organization in your hospital, and when you go to budget for the next year, those losses have to be captured somewhere, and those losses have to be shifted probably to the private segment. And as John said, with the insurance coverage, at least our hospitals begin to recapture that. And I certainly would not want to see hospitals suffer on their budgets because of their quality of care. And we're very fortunate, being a rural district, that we have the quality of care in our local hospitals and the availability of care, too.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking with a few Republican state lawmakers about the proposed budget and their priorities. We spoke last week before the Republican Party of Wisconsin's annual convention in La Crosse. So I've heard some backroom conversations, some lawmakers saying that this proposed budget that was put out by Governor Walker, this is not the Republicans' budget. This is just Governor Walker's budget.
I think that's always the way the process has worked. It's the governor makes his proposal, as I said, in early November, and it's his budget at that point in time. And when it comes to the legislature and we begin to make changes, it becomes legislature's budget. When it's all said and done, it will be our budget.
Like I said, I've been here now for 6 budgets, and I didn't understand why the governor puts everything in the budget, any governor, whatever party they are, because that's the only bill the only bill they actually get to bring forward. And then you just go through the process. He puts out what the governor puts out what they want. Then we start doing our process of going out, having public hearings on it, and then we start having our own, and Joint Finance starts voting on it. And so it is a long process. It seems like a long process, but it doesn't take so long.
If you live it, it's a lot longer.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I don't see any different than any other budget. Somebody asked me the other day, are you catching a lot of grief on this one? I said, no more than any other budget that's come out. So
I'm kind of curious, you know, we're hearing a lot about Governor Scott Walker's travels, and, you know, he has not announced he's running for president, but he's been traveling throughout the U.S. and out of the country quite a bit. I'm wondering if just his increase in travels, has that impacted much of the decision-making in this process?
You know, so this is the second time I've been the co-chair, so I worked on the last budget and worked closely with the governor's office. You know, I mean, the Democrats want to make that an issue. Nothing has changed. I still have the same weekly meetings that I had, you know, 2 years ago. Quite honestly, I mean, most of the time it's with staff. It was with staff 2 years ago. It's with its chief of staff. But there are opportunities. The governor was involved in the discussion with Milwaukee on the Bucks Arena a couple weeks ago. He's going to be involved in the discussion this coming week with lawmakers all in the room together. So I mean, it really hasn't changed from 2 years ago to now.
I'm wondering too, like once the Joint Finance Committee, once you get through the budget and decide this is what you're going to bring forward to the legislature, will there be room for amendments, whether it's made, you know, either on the floor, you know, within caucuses, or are you just hoping you can put it out there and no changes are made?
Well, these guys might have a different answer than I would. Typically, what we try to get to, and it's why we have the process we do where we have these regular meetings with the members to get their input. Typically, we like to be able to, the Joint Finance process, for the most part, the Joint Finance budget be the final budget. But, you know, there have been amendments that have come up on the floor in the past, you know, so never say never.
1 year, I think there were 100 amendments that were brought up on the floor.
Wow.
Typically, those are from the minority.
Yeah, from the minority. Usually, with the process we have, the majority, whoever the majority is, they have it pretty much set when they come, because you go through the process that we go through. So, but you get some years you get a lot of amendments brought out, mainly by the minority.
Representative Vandermeer, bringing out your first amendment this year?
yes, I've communicated a couple of my issues that are very specific to our district.
Like what?
Some of the rural transportation issues, and then also some college credit issues for our local school districts, so that they could have some funding for that. And really, that's more of a transcripting cost, so that they could have that incorporated into their UW transcript as high school students. The disproportionate share cost for the hospitals, I brought that to their attention too, and I alluded to that briefly after John's comments on health care. So those were just a few of the issues. I try to really focus on the rural issues in our area. I know Lee does that a lot as well, and just kind of heighten that awareness. But as John said too, we also have to bear in mind we represent the whole state with our other colleagues as well, and try to understand and come to terms with their issues along the way.
And as you're crafting the budget and putting forward the final budget, are you thinking about possible vetoes that could come from the governor?
I'm sure. Well, I mean, like I said, I have weekly meetings with the governor's office, and, you know, as things are being proposed and things are coming up, we'll bring them up and, you know, see what kind of response we get. There are times even if we don't get a positive response, you know, our members have, if they have a firm or hard feelings about something, or, you know, are very committed to it, we're going to move forward. Oftentimes we'll get a veto assurance. Other times we may not, but that doesn't mean we won't go forward.
I'm kind of curious, Representative Nierson, are there other legislative issues that you are hoping come out either through the budget or through bills that you may be proposing later on?
Just locally. I haven't even talked too much with the legislature on this, other than the local issue with the railroad and being charged with trespassing to get to the river when
sure.
they cross the tracks. That's an issue that has gotten to be really big here along all the way down. It's 200 miles,
mm-hmm.
and that's gotten a real big issue now.
Is that something that the state can work? Would you have to work either with the individual railroad companies, or I'm assuming you'd have to get the feds involved too?
Well, yeah, you'd have to probably get them involved, because actually this, it goes clear back to Abraham Lincoln before he got into the Illinois legislature, because he was a lawyer for the railroads, and it was to get Pinkerton on the railroads for protection. And it goes back that far. So, and then for about 150 years, it was exempt for crossing the tracks. And then in 2006, it changed. And people shouldn't be walking up and down the tracks, or they shouldn't be fishing off over a railroad bridge. I mean, that's just common sense. But
there are plenty of people who need to cross.
They have to cross. They're going to take out so much of the river that people aren't even going to get to use.
Anything else with the Agriculture Committee this year, too?
To start off right now, the DADCAP, the board and the secretary, they go through a lot of their rules. And I think I have 50 rules coming that they're working on. They'll be coming to the committee.
Okay.
So that takes up a lot of your time on that. And so far, there haven't been any bills brought up for the Ag Committee.
Get past the budget.
Get past the budget and then see from there. There's one thing in ag, they don't want to see a lot of bills. Leave me alone, let me do my work. So if it's really something they need, then they're going to come. Otherwise, they're not even going to come and ask for anything. So.
And Representative Vandermeer, either within the budget or any other issues beyond the budget?
Yes. In fact, last week I introduced a bill, and it's called the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. And what that allows for are individual states to electively join the compact, and it would make licensure for physicians more efficient as far as time. It does not circumvent any of the state licensing processes. It just makes it easier once a physician, a board-certified physician, is accepted into the compact. And a lot of groups, when I talk to them about this, I kind of get a glazed look in their eyes once in a while. And what it does, I believe it will serve our rural medical facilities very well, because where the patient is where the physician needs to be licensed. So I'll give you an example. If we have a patient that comes into the hospital in Sparta, Wisconsin, they're exhibiting stroke symptoms, maybe we need to administer that protocol to have a better outcome, to have less residual effects of the stroke. If we don't have a physician on call at that point to prescribe that protocol, the patient doesn't get it. The outcome is not as good. Therefore, we can have physicians who are perhaps licensed in other states or be in other states who can prescribe that particular protocol. Telemedicine is an amazing avenue to deliver this as well. So there's a lot of things that it can touch on. And, you know, much like John talked about technology and education, this is where some of this comes now into the medical area. And that's something we've talked about in the medical area for a long, long time. But it would also, we have a mental health care shortage of clinicians in our state, especially for the rural areas. This is another area that would serve to get that treatment into those underserved areas.
Representative Nancy Vandermeer represents Toma. Representative Lee Nearson of Westby and Representative John Nygren of Marinette all joined us today. They are talking about the proposed budget and their priorities. We spoke last week before the Republican Party of Wisconsin's annual convention in La Crosse. Coming up next, a couple Wisconsin lawmakers are trying to gain support for a bill they say could give better protections for child sex trafficking victims. To catch this episode and any other recent edition of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. As many as 325,000 children in North America are at risk of becoming victims of sexual exploitation every year. That's according to a study from the University of Pennsylvania. If one of those children ends up becoming a victim of sex trafficking and is arrested for prostitution in Wisconsin, he or she could be fined or sent to jail. Two Wisconsin lawmakers want to change that law and want the courts to provide a safe harbor for children who are victims of sex trafficking. Here today to talk about that bill are Representative Jill Billings of La Crosse and Representative LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee. So, Representative Johnson, I understand that you and Representative Billings essentially took two bills that you had been working on and combined it to create this piece of legislation. Why was it that you saw that this was something that was needed? Why do we need to change this law in Wisconsin?
We need to change this law because criminalizing these kids prevents their ability to just experience any type of normalcy in their life, including finding housing. And not to mention, I am not aware of any other crime where the victims are penalized in order to prosecute the offender. So that's a huge concern for our area.
And Representative Billings, so as the state law is now, if someone who's under the age of 18 is arrested for prostitution, she or he could be fined $10,000 max. They could end up having to serve a nine-month sentence in jail.
Yes. So under current law, children who are victims of human trafficking can be arrested and taken into jail and charged. Now, down the road, they could try to expunge this from their records, but if someone's applying for college or financial aid, if they're applying for a job, they're asked if they've ever been committed committing a crime, and so they would have to answer yes. So what happens is these kids are brought in through the revolving door of the criminal justice system, and it's kind of tough to get back into regular life.
And some may say, well, they're involved in prostitution, but you two, and I know there are many others around the world even, who are saying, look, they are victims. They're not necessarily committing any crimes.
And that's correct. These children are victims. The average age a child typically enters into human trafficking can be as young as 13 years of age. And any child under the age of 18, they're not old enough to legally give consent. So that's a huge concern for us. And the problem with labeling these children as prostitutes, it can cause problems with finding housing, which is the number one issue that we have with trying to make sure that these children can find safety. If these children are deemed as prostitutes or even human trafficking victims through the juvenile justice system or our adult prisons, then they no longer find themselves eligible for foster care in the sense that other children know of. Because this is such a serious crime, our Department of Children and Families, they don't want to mix the two populations because they have a difficult enough time trying to find good foster homes. But these children come with their own set of issues. And for some of these children that are forced into the juvenile justice system through JIS, which is Juveniles in Need of Protection or Services, these are court-ordered sanctions. Most of them are criminal sanctions. So then when you look at issues with housing, like, for example, the Family Unification Program that's administered through HUD that allows children between the ages of 18 and 21 who are leaving foster care and who are in need of housing, these children don't qualify because you can't qualify for those programs if you're on a JIPS order. And that's a huge concern for us as well.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking with two state lawmakers about proposed legislation that would create a safe harbor for child sex trafficking victims. My guests are Representative Jill Billings of La Crosse, and joining us by phone is Representative LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee. So, under federal law, minors will not be prosecuted, will not be arrested for prostitution. But so is this almost a way for states to catch up with these federal laws?
This legislation does bring us in line with federal legislation that says that children should not be charged, that they are victims, they should have a safe harbor. It also brings us in line with our neighbors, Illinois and Minnesota and Michigan, who have safe harbor legislation. We'd be the 23rd state to offer safe harbor. In Minnesota, what they found is after they offered safe harbor, the number of convictions of perpetrators doubled because rather than setting up an adversarial situation with the kids that are brought in, it's more of a protection for the kids and getting services for the kids, and then they cooperate.
Do you know how many children, because essentially these are children, have been arrested in recent years in Wisconsin as prostitutes?
We don't have a sense as to what the numbers are because there hasn't been any research dedicated to actually finding the concrete data so we know exactly how many children that this crime entails. I know that there was a total of about 77 girls from the city of Milwaukee, and that information was discovered through the Homicide Review Commission. So there needs to be more research. We need to dedicate a task force or study committee to actually pinpointing how many children are affected in this state.
And Representative Johnson, you mentioned that number of 77 minors that the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission found were being trafficked. Most of those were African American girls between the ages of, I believe it was 12 and 17.
It's unbelievable. And when you think about the number of children in the city of Milwaukee on any given night, we have about 450 youth who are roaming the streets in the city of Milwaukee. And when you think about the number of youth who may potentially be stopped for prostitution, but instead of doing investigations, finding out why these children are out there, they're usually giving tickets for curfew or disorderly conduct tickets. Because long before a child is ever labeled for prostitution or human trafficking, they typically have other offenses or other related tickets that lead up to the actual arrest. And so when you look at the number of children who may be misidentified, and we may actually be missing those windows of opportunity to get these children help, it's really alarming.
All agencies that have been tracking and trying to look at data to see what the numbers are, every agency says that it's very, very underreported. If I talk to our DA or law enforcement.
Here in La Crosse County?
Yes, they've said that they know it's here. It just flies under the radar screen. It's hard to kind of put your hands on. Part of that, I think, has to do with education of law enforcement and also and judges and people who work in emergency rooms, people who work with social services, and all of us as a whole. Part of it has to do with education and being able to spot where this is occurring. I think Milwaukee has a significant number of kids that are trafficked. But I think what's also interesting and why I really enjoy working on this with Representative Johnson is that she's from Milwaukee, I'm from La Crosse. We're from opposite sides of the state. But we both have a concern, and we both know that this exists throughout our state. There have been reports in over half of our 72 counties of kids being trafficked. So we know that it's everywhere in Wisconsin. There's a safe house for kids up in Appleton where they have a human trafficking there. We've had incidences in La Crosse and Milwaukee. It's everywhere, and so we have to just be more aware of it.
In La Crosse, do we have any sense as to whether or not children who are victims of sex trafficking, are they from this area? Are they from southwest Wisconsin? Are they moving in, you know, through the highway? Because we hear about Interstate 90 being a huge highway for sex trafficking.
I think it's a mix. I think that there are kids that are being trafficked who are from our area who are homeless and end up being trafficked. I think there are kids that are being moved around the state, and there are kids that are being moved around the country. So some of our kids end up being moved maybe down to New Orleans and then back through the circuit and have a very, very difficult experience.
So another part of this bill that you two have introduced would require child welfare agencies to investigate all child sexual exploitation cases. Representative Johnson, can you tell us why this portion of the law needs to be changed? How does this differ from what's currently going on?
It differs because currently, if the perpetrator is not a parent, a guardian, or a caregiver, then the Department of Children and Families is permitted to investigate rather than required. So there is no statutory law that requires the Department of Children and Families to investigate these crimes if the perpetrator isn't a parent, a guardian, or caregiver. And in so many of the instances that we are aware of, the perpetrators are not related to the victim. And so, therefore, these individuals are never investigated. And when you talk about your pimp and your perpetrators, and the fact that it's nationally known that these individuals can have anywhere from 2 to 5 girls in their stable, which is their collection of victims, that becomes increasingly important. Because when we do find a human trafficking victim, is that the only victim that this perpetrator has? How many other victims are out there? And the other thing is that we need to find out why these children are running away. Why are they leaving their home? If these children are being sexually abused, if they're being physically abused, and they have younger siblings, those individuals are at risk too. And if these children are afraid to return home for whatever reason, then that's a huge concern, and it needs to be investigated so we can get to the bottom of what are the issues at home, what are the issues being experienced by those children so we can actually do something about it.
So, Representative Billings, it's almost like the agency could dig deeper into what the total situation is and, you know, how to really stop it.
Exactly. This could be an open door for a situation that can be very dangerous for other children, too.
So could this potentially come down a little harder on pimps and johns and even, you know, people who are looking at child pornography on the Internet, too, Representative Billings?
Well, in human trafficking, there are really three entities that are involved. There is the victim, the person that's trafficked. There's a person that's doing the trafficking, sometimes known as a pimp. And then there's the person who, the demand side of it, the person who's buying. There are a lot of ways that we can help in this situation and put an end to this. One way is education. to make sure that people that are buying understand that this is not a victimless crime, that there is somebody who is hurting, who is being often forced into this trade, forced to do the things that they have to do. It's important for people to know that, especially the people that are keeping this industry going by doing the purchasing.
With the introduction of this bill, and if this bill ends up passing, you know, you say you want the different agencies to get involved. Will the state need more resources?
There will be a need for additional resources because these victims are going to come with a wealth of issues. They're going to need mental health counseling. They're going to need medical care because a lot of these young women, they haven't had medical care. A lot of them are going to have sexually transmitted diseases that have gone undetected because they're not allowed to go for checkups. And it's a public health risk as well because these individuals are servicing their Johns. So Johns typically return home to their unassuming family. And so when you look at how much not doing anything to combat this crime is costing this state, it is costing this state a lot. It's costing this state in criminal justice resources in terms of investigations and prosecution. So it's costing us because some of these individuals have children. And so we have to provide care and assistance, most time economic assistance, for these families. So when we count up all the costs, the only person who isn't paying for this crime in most of the cases are the perpetrators. The dollars he's collecting off of the backs of his victims, those dollars are not going towards state taxes. They are not going to help provide services to those communities. They're going in his pocket. And this is a crime that needs to have more resources devoted toward it, especially in terms of housing for these individuals. They need a safe place to go.
And Representative Johnson, do you see more laws needing to be passed to sort of address these different issues?
We are. We're going to have to do a lot more in this state to protect our most vulnerable, which are our children. We are going to need to have additional services in place. We are going to need to set aside additional funding to make sure that our law enforcement is trained and to make sure that these children aren't further victimized.
Representative Johnson and I are really focused on this issue, and I don't believe we're going to stop with this legislation. There's other legislation that would help in this issue, whether it's more education for in schools or with law enforcement. I like the idea of having someone who is like a human trafficking czar. I can't find a better term for that, but somebody who oversees this statewide. There are models from other states around us, our neighbors, who are doing a much better job with this issue and a much better job for their children. And so there is more legislation coming down the line. I know that legislators on both sides of the aisle are concerned about this. The faith community is starting to weigh in. The public is becoming more educated on this issue. There was a show on public TV, A Path Appears, that gave a really good look at behind the scenes of human trafficking and ways to help people get out of human trafficking and get back on the right track. So there are good models out there.
So are you confident that this bill will pass within this session?
What do you think, LaTanya?
I'm not confident that this bill will pass.
You're not
it
confident.
It needs to pass. Yeah. And I think privately, everyone on both sides of the aisle will agree that this is something that needs to be done. But unfortunately, I think in terms of being able to finance it, I don't know if the motivation is necessarily there because the money is going to have to come from somewhere. And the question is, where would the money come from, especially when we are not willing to make this a priority at this time?
We don't know exactly what the price tag would be for this because we don't really have a good idea about the data. But we know that there are kids who need services. They need a safe place to stay. and this is an important issue. So I'm hoping that down the line we can address it. We're making sure, though, that we have the conversation and that people are aware of this. I am slightly hopeful that in some cities we can get community providers involved and maybe do some sort of private-public partnerships as people are waking up to this and have concern over this issue and what's happening with our children with human trafficking, that we need a place to make them feel valued and help them get back on the right track.
Representative Jill Billings is a Democrat from La Crosse, and Representative LaTanya Johnson is a Democrat from Milwaukee. Today, they were talking about proposed legislation that would create a safe harbor for child sex trafficking victims. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. Visit WPR.org/newsmakers to find a link to the proposed bill. There, you can also listen to today's program and other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share a comment or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.